Justice O'Donnell is attending a funeral today in Cleveland, and so he will not be participating in oral arguments, but he will be participating in the decisions in the cases. Justice Pfeiffer, I understand, I guess there's a lot of traffic complications out away from here, and so Justice Pfeiffer is still involved in those. He will be here, and of course he'll be participating in all the cases we hear. First case is 08-1499, State of Ohio versus Anthony Jackson. Ms. Tatarsky.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Honors. My name is Kathleen Tatarsky, and I'm here representing the State of Ohio. With me at council table is Kevin Lamadue, who's representing the various amicus in this matter, including the City of Canton and the Ohio Municipal League. I would like to speak for 10 minutes and discuss why there is no Garrity violation here and leave 5 minutes for Mr. Lamadue and rebuttal to discuss various issues, including the impact of the decision of the Court of Appeals on the municipalities. This case involves a police officer, Anthony Jackson, who was indicted for a felony, namely carrying a firearm into a Class D liquor establishment. Around the same time that Mr. Jackson was indicted for this felony, an internal investigation was being done by the City of Canton Internal Affairs Bureau, specifically Lieutenant Davis. This case presents the issue of the impact of a Garrity statement which Mr. Jackson gave during the internal affairs investigation, and which was obtained by the trial prosecutor, on the facts of this case. Essentially, the state would ask this court to answer the question, should a police officer, a public official, have more rights under the Fifth Amendment than the very suspects which he arrests? In this case, the courts below, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals, gave Mr. Jackson more rights than, for example, a suspect given a coerced confession would give. The state would state that this
Counsel, did you say a suspect given a coerced confession?
Yes, who has given a coerced confession. That confession is theoretically suppressed, but it doesn't lead to a dismissal of the indictment.
So that's mainly your argument here, is that the remedy as proposed by the lower courts is in error, but you would admit that this is equivalent to a coerced confession?
It because it was given immunity and Mr. Jackson was told that the statement or the fruits of it would not be used in any criminal proceeding, that it has the same effect as a coerced confession and cannot be used in a criminal trial. In other words, Mr. Jackson has the same Fifth Amendment protections with his Garrity statement as does a suspect whose statement or confession is involuntary. First, I would like to discuss why there is no Garrity violation here. Second, I'd like to discuss the concern of the Court of Appeals here, and specifically that was the use of the statement of Vince Vann by the prosecutor. And third, I would like to address the cross appeal of Mr. Jackson, where he requests that because there was a Garrity violation, which he alleges that the indictment should be dismissed and that there is no real evidentiary way to handle this situation. There was no Garrity violation here because the trial prosecutor was able to demonstrate at the Castigar hearing that he had an independent source from which he could proceed with the prosecution of Mr. Jackson. Specifically, at the Castigar hearing, the prosecutor had the Perry Township policeman, Sergeant Roethlisberger, testify. The sergeant testified to what he saw on that night, which included Mr. Jackson having a gun, and the sergeant came to the bar, Lou's Tavern, three times and finally escorted Mr. Jackson off of the property. This independent source was nothing that involved Mr. Jackson's Garrity statement that was given. the fact that the prosecutor had knowledge of that Garrity statement was not a violation. The Court of Appeals and the trial court both were wrong in finding that knowledge
Counsel,
of the-
Counsel, let me ask you, did the arresting officer have knowledge of the names of the two witnesses that I believe were produced through the Garrity statement?
Chief Justice, or I'm sorry, Justice Connor, the only name that was given by Anthony Jackson in the Garrity statement was Vince Vann. And that statement and that name was not known by the Perry Township Police. There is some discussion in the briefs of Mr. Jackson that Tina Ogle was also given by Mr. Jackson, but a review of that statement of Mr. Jackson, his Garrity statement, Tina Ogle was never mentioned by Mr. Jackson. He discussed somebody, some woman sitting at the bar, but he never said a name. And so the only derivative statement that was received from Mr. Jackson's Garrity statement was the name of Vince Vann. And the prosecutor did have the statement that was contained in the internal affairs file of Mr. Vann, but there the prosecutor never used that, and in fact, since this matter was dismissed by the trial court prior to trial, he never introduced it and never had an attempt to use it in cross-examination, and it's the state's contention that there were several ways through evidence, evidentiary rulings, that the court could have kept out the use of Vince Vann if, in fact, the prosecutor tried to use it.
Although, wasn't there an investigation of Mr. Vann based on that immunized statement that was given?
There was a interview, a telephone interview done by Lieutenant Davis of Mr. Vann. And the state would concede that the trial prosecutor did have that interview.
But isn't that the point? If you're talking about an immunized statement, any use whatsoever of information within that statement by the prosecutor or by the state would be violative of Garrity?
There was no evidence, Justice Lanzinger, that the statement of Vince Vann was used by the prosecutor in any way. The fact that the prosecutor knew of the statement, Mr. Vann was never named as a witness. He was not called at the grand jury. And in fact, he was brought up in discovery by Mr. Jackson as a witness. He was never used, Your Honor, by the prosecutor. The fact that he knew about it is not enough to make a Garrity violation.
Counsel, do we have in the record exactly the representations and promises that were made to this police officer before he gave his statement to the folks making the inquiry?
Yes, Justice Pfeiffer, that is in the record. You have the interview of Mr. Jackson, which was taped, and you have the transcript.
And what specifically was he promised?
He was promised that anything he said during his statement would not be used in any criminal prosecution, as well as any fruits of anything that he said during the statement would not be used in any criminal prosecution.
And how does turning that statement over to the prosecutor conform to that promise?
Justice Pfeiffer, just turning the statement over to the prosecutor did not violate Mr. Jackson's Garrity rights or anything that was said during that statement. The state would concede that if the trial prosecutor tried to use that statement of Mr. Jackson, say in the event that he testified and he tried to peach him with that or whatever.
Wouldn't it be reasonable for the officer to assume that statement that he made, whatever statements he made, would remain in the police files and would not be handed over to the prosecuting authorities?
No, Justice Pfeiffer, that would not be reasonable. It was almost incumbent upon the trial prosecutor or someone in the prosecutor's office to review that Garrity statement. It could have contained, although it didn't in this case, some exculpatory material. There may have been a Brady issue there.
So that's why the prosecutor wanted to see if there was exculpatory material in it.
That is one of the reasons, yes, Your Honor. Another reason, there are certain circumstances in which that internal affairs file would be public record. It would be rather ironic if that's Garrity statement in the internal affairs file was released to, say, the Canton repository, and the prosecutor didn't have it. So there is no Garrity violation, according that the state argues, by the mere knowledge that the trial prosecutor had of the Garrity statement.
Counsel, are you saying these internal investigatory statements could be public records? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. In certain circumstances, they could be public record.
What circumstances?
If under public records, and specifically under, I believe, this case that this court has held in State Ex Rel Ohio Patrolman's Benevolent Association versus Mentor, where they held that an internal affairs investigation in certain circumstances when it did not involve an uncharged suspect, et cetera, could be a public record.
Well, it's an uncharged suspect. That wouldn't apply to this gentleman because he had been charged.
That's correct. And that's why the state would say that in certain circumstances, this could be public record.
And a lot of states deal with the Garrity issue by not giving the report to the prosecutor. Therefore, there's no danger of a taint in that, because when you give the report, as the defense says, you now know exactly what the defendant's going to say, what his defense is, what Mr. Van is going to say, and you can formulate your trial strategy very differently. And how do you, as the brief say, unring that bell, or as the trial judge said?
There are a few states that do hold that, and I'm thinking of the particular case of United States versus Daniels, which pretty much said that mere knowledge by the prosecutor would be enough to be a Garrity violation. Essentially, that case said that they gave the police officer, in that case, a transactional immunity. But that's not, in fact, what Garrity said. Justice, there's not any doubt that there are different ways to handle a Garrity statement, but the state contends that just the mere knowledge that the prosecutor has of that statement without a showing that it was used in some way in the criminal prosecution is not a Garrity violation.
Counsel, it never got to the use level, did it?
No,
wasn't
Your
this
Honor.
Dismissed prior to trial?
That's correct.
And in the appellate opinion from the Fifth District at paragraph 29, it states that the appellant stipulated to the fact that Mr. Van was unknown to the state prior to the Garrity interview of August of 07.
That's correct.
Okay, so to say that Mr. Van, number one, was unknown until the Garrity, it was then made use of by the prosecutor through a report of the interview and the taping of Mr. Van's interview released to the prosecutor. It's just to the point he never got to the stage where that would have been introduced or become an issue at trial.
Justice Connor, it wasn't a use, it was knowledge by the prosecutor, but the prosecutor didn't use it. He never named Mr. Van on his witness list. He never interviewed him. He didn't have a chance to use it at trial, if indeed he ever would have. But mere knowledge of Mr. Van's statement is not enough to be a Garrity violation.
How does your statement comply with the statement in the opinion of the Supreme Court in Castigar, which is on page 453 of their opinion, 441, I guess it is, it, referring to the immunity, prohibits the prosecutorial authorities from using the compelled testimony in any respect, and it therefore ensures that the testimony cannot lead to the infliction of criminal penalties on the witness. In any respect, how would you apply that term?
I would apply it, Chief Justice, to be use is more than knowledge. In this case, there was absolutely no use of anything, and that was shown at the Castigar hearing. That's the purpose of the Castigar hearing, for the prosecutor to show that there was no use and that they derived their information and the way they were going to proceed at trial through independent sources. And so
if the law enforcement authorities contact a person whose name appears in the Katzegar hearing for the first time, and not no trial, but they contact the purported witness, is that use in any respect?
No, Chief Justice, it isn't use until it is used in the criminal prosecution, until it is used at trial, used for cross-examination, used for impeachment, named as a witness, etc. But the mere knowledge of it is not a Katzegar or a Garrity violation.
So in your opinion, you can get a Garrity statement, investigate every aspect of it, interview all the witnesses listed in it, and as long as you don't use that information in the trial, you're okay.
If you can demonstrate at a Katzegar hearing, and that is the purpose of such a hearing, that you have independent sources for your criminal prosecution, then the abstract possibility that you may know about it is not enough to be a Garrity violation. That is the position of the state.
And if you don't have independent sources, what's the circumstance then?
If there's no independent sources and you need to rely on the Garrity violation or the Garrity statement or any fruits of it to proceed with your prosecution, either through the indictment, you use it in the indictment as it was done in Conrad, or in the trial, then in fact it is a Garrity violation, but that is not what happened here.
And if you merely contact a witness, not merely, but if you contact a witness because the person's name appears for the first time, you have no independent knowledge of it, but there's no trial, no indictments. Well, there's an indictment. So what's the circumstance?
Well, of course, that didn't happen here, but
right. But we have to write law here. This obviously is an area in which we need to try to write
sure,
a bright line if we
absolutely.
Can.
Absolutely. Following that, I think that absolutely there would need to be a Katzegar hearing, and that would certainly come out, and the trial court would have to review that on a case-by-case basis and see if the prosecution's contact with that witness had anything to do with the criminal prosecution. For the reasons suggested in the state's brief, we would request that this court reverse and find no Garrity violation and also proceed in with the indictment on this and allow Mr. Jackson to go to trial. Thank you very much.
We've left no time for Mr. Lamadou. You want him to take rebuttal?
Yes.
Mr. Hyams.
Thank you. Please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is Bradley Iams. I'm the attorney for Anthony Jackson, as I have been throughout these proceedings. I'd like to first address this burden of proof issue, because I think that sets a tone for a lot of what happened in the trial court and why we are here today. The prosecutor keeps talking about this Katzegar hearing. They had a Katzegar hearing, and they lost it. That's what the judge did. They had an opportunity at a Katzegar hearing to demonstrate to the trial judge that they had not made improper use of this statement. They had the opportunity to do a lot of things that they say in their brief that they could have done. For example, they could have brought the prosecutor who presented the case in grand jury in and had him testify or provide a statement from that person. They didn't do it. They could have brought Lieutenant Davis, who is the investigating officer, who, and keep in mind, this officer is simply the internal affairs officer. It really had nothing to do with the underlying criminal case, which was being investigated by a township police department. They didn't bring Lieutenant Davis in. They didn't present any statements from him saying, this is how we kept these things separate. So the trial judge is faced with that. They bring the officer in, and he says, yes, this is the evidence that I have. This is the evidence that I didn't have. In addition to that, there were stipulations that are part of the record that where they stipulated, for example, we didn't know who Vince Vann was. Now, the trial court is faced with that. It's their burden of proof. And I think the appellant makes a brief argument in their brief that somehow the burden of proof was not on them. But it clearly is. It clearly is in a Katzegar hearing. And it's a heavy burden, as the Supreme Court said.
Counsel, the prosecutor claims that adopting the Court of Appeals position gives the officer more rights than a defendant that's not a police officer. the briefs all filed on your side claim the opposite, that adopting the state's position gives them less rights than a criminal defendant. How does it give them less rights? I could not quite follow your argument about less rights. I could follow their argument about more rights, but not yours about less rights. So clarify that.
I think you'll find those arguments in the amicus brief. I don't believe I made that argument, but I did see them making that argument. And where I think both of those arguments miss the boat is when they talk about more rights than a citizen, this is a unique position. And with Garrity, where you have a public employer who is also doing the investigation, an ordinary citizen, if I work at Republic Steel and I'm accused of something, my employer can bring me in. He doesn't have to read me a Garrity warning. He doesn't have to read me a Miranda warning. He can question me, and if he wants to fire me for not answering, he doesn't like my answers, he can fire me. But this is a unique situation. It seems to me that the argument that they have about this more rights or less rights should be addressed to the Supreme Court in Garrity, because that's where, if you go back to Garrity, that's where the Supreme Court first created this situation. I don't think they really had to. I mean, the Supreme Court, and I think you read the dissent in Garrity, I think some of those justices were not happy with that resolution. And I think the Supreme Court perhaps could have analyzed that and said, well, you have no greater right. It's an employer employment situation. We're not going to involve the Fifth Amendment. But the court didn't do that. The court said, because of this unique circumstance, because this is the government who's acting as the employer and as the investigator, we're going to assume that the Fifth Amendment applies.
Also, in the discovery, were you at the trial level?
Yes, I was. Okay. I've been there.
You revealed Mr. Van as a potential witness. How does that change the state's ability then to go out, interview Mr. Van, and pursue him as a witness?
Well, I think if you look at the time frame on this, I listed Vince Van as a witness. This is almost a year later, where they obtained the name of Vince Van. This happens prior to indictment. So we have a complaint filed in a municipal court. The case is bound over. The internal affairs investigation begins immediately.
Right. I understand that you gave his name much later in the game. I'm just asking, does that change their ability to then use him as a witness or talk to him since you now have declared him?
I think it changes it, perhaps in the idea that they're now aware of him, but it doesn't change fundamentally what they were able to do by getting that name early and go in and interview that witness based upon the statement they had from Jackson in terms of trial preparation.
So if they had not done anything with Mr. Van and waited until you actually revealed him in discovery, then they would have been all right to go out and interview him as a fresh witness declared by you.
On that particular issue, but I think the fact that they had this pretrial roadmap from the defendant that they coerced was something that clearly troubled the trial court. And this is a trial judge who went to fairly extraordinary lengths to explain his decision. And it's an 18, 19-page decision where the trial judge is clearly troubled by this idea of unringing the bell, and a trial judge who sits and hears these cases and understands the advantage that you get as a prosecutor in having this statement in advance where you can compel it. And we all know is in civil litigation, if you don't go out and take a deposition of your opponent, you're almost committing malpractice. So there's a clear advantage. So I think that although this Vince Van issue is something that's easy to point to, I mean, that's a tangible thing that they wouldn't have had that. It's not just about that witness. It's more, I think, about this, the general idea that you're getting something that you wouldn't ordinarily have. You're getting it early in the case, and you're getting it in a way that maybe, and the trial judge struggled with that too. I think his language was, I can't necessarily tell you exactly how it helps him, but I know it helps him.
Counsel,
we all know that.
Counsel, would you have us go so far as to write a rule that these statements cannot be turned over to the prosecutor whatsoever if they're in internal investigation statements?
I think it's absolutely the rule that should be written. And I think that in occasions where somehow it slips out. Now, maybe there is an occasion where maybe a small department where they didn't anticipate that this was going to happen. So if there are occasions where a Garrity statement does end up in the hands of a prosecutor by inadvertence, and that's somewhat what Conrad was. I don't think Conrad was this obscure or somewhat obscure statute that talked about immunity, and I think that there was no bad faith there for the prosecutor and Conrad, but when they find out, now you have to have a Garrity or have to have a Castigar hearing. But I think the rule this court should write is very clearly that you shouldn't turn these things over. And that's the simplest way to police this, And if there, as I said, if there's somehow it gets away, then you have a Castigar hearing.
You know that periodically there are thoughts of liberalizing Criminal Rule 16. Would you see these statements as being an exception to the ordinary witness statement then?
No, I don't think that that's, I think just because of the nature of the Fifth Amendment issue involved, that if a defendant chooses to make a statement is one thing, but to say that you're going to take a criminal defendant and coerce that person, and this is, although maybe not a sworn statement, he's under the circumstances, you're ordered to make that statement, and there are consequences for making falsehoods in that statement. You can be charged with various offenses, both internally and probably criminally. I think that's much different than just a witness statement. I mean, this is something that's compelled from a defendant who, and keep in mind, this is an exception. The general rule is you don't have to talk to the police, and this is a carved-out exception. And I think this is much different than what appellant is talking about as far as coerced statements. Because this is a premeditated thing. When you're talking about a normal exclusionary case where you have a police officer who steps over the line or a police officer who doesn't cross all his T's and dot all his I's, generally speaking, that's an error that the court has to look at later and determine, did the constable blunder, and what are we going to do about that? And, of course, there's a lot of opinions both ways. With these types of cases, this is absolutely premeditated, and this is a decision that lawyers are making. Are we going to take this Garrity statement? What are we going to do with it? Because they don't have to do it. I mean, that's a decision that they make. And ironically, in this situation, and the record clearly reflects this, although they claim we had to do this Garrity statement because we can't wait to do this discipline, by contract with the City of Canton and the Patrolmen's Association, they weren't permitted to go forward with disciplinary action until the criminal case was done. They had agreed in advance. So there really was no rush. This was something they made a decision. We want to find out what, we want to tie this guy down and find out what he has to say.
Let me take you to the remedy. The remedy the Court of Appeals fashioned was to try to purge the file and let another prosecutor take it as if he had never had the Garrity statement. This is an easier case to argue for dismissal. But let's change the facts and say you have an officer accused of murder. And you've got victims and you've got a lot of other issues to be worried about other than, you know, this type of fact pattern where dismissal would probably not have a lot of consequences. What is wrong with the remedy the Court of Appeals fashioned in a much more serious indictment where a dismissal has some pretty devastating consequences?
Well, of course, those are always the hard cases. I don't believe the Court of Appeals fashioned that remedy with that in mind. The way I read the Court of Appeals, at least the majority opinion, was they read Conrad as saying, well, Conrad required dismissal because it was in the indictment stage. And so they read Conrad fairly narrowly and said, well, this didn't involve indictment, so we're not bound by Conrad with a dismissal. But I guess my answer to that question is I think dismissal is the remedy on facts like these where it's premeditated, and we don't have to guess about whether the prosecutor benefited from having the statement. The prosecutor in the trial court, in his pleadings, said, we have had the benefit of having this statement for pretrial preparation.
So why isn't the Court of Appeals remedy sufficient? As I recall, they required the file to be stripped of this information and a special prosecutor appointed that has no knowledge of this. Why would that not cure the problem?
Well, it may cure the problem. I don't think it accomplishes the deterrent aspect of it. Whether you could actually make that work, I'm not sure how you make it work, and they appealed and I didn't. But I don't know how you really make that work, but I suppose in a certain case it could, but it doesn't really address the deterrent aspect of it. And remember, we had a prosecutor here in the trial court who said, yeah, we had the benefit of it now, and yeah, we've done it in the past, and I can pretty much guarantee you if they get their way and the rule from this court comes out that, yeah, they're allowed to have these statements as long as there's not making direct evidentiary use, they're going to do it.
Well, it seemed to me, however, though, if you require anybody that's seen the statement or read the statement, we're talking about contents, not just the existence of a statement, I guess, to be off the case, appoint a special prosecutor, which costs the the county or the city money. The information is no longer in the file. And if the only issue is deterrent, because this information is no longer available to the prosecution, it seems to me that would be a significant deterrent. I don't know how many prosecutors' offices are going to want to have their authority over cases stripped away and have to pay out money to hire a special prosecutor.
Well, I would agree in the sense that what Castigar tells us is you have to put that person back in substantially the same position they would have been had they not been forced to give the statement. So for those purposes, yeah, it very well may be sufficient. But I don't think you can discount the deterrent effect of it. And I think that is one of the things that this court in Conrad talked about. In fact, they specifically addressed that, because I think that was one of the suggestions in Conrad.
But counsel, if there was the rule written, as Justice Lansinger suggested, that we do a bright line that no disclosure of a Garrity file be afforded the prosecuting attorney, that's a prospective remedy that I think takes care of it not only for this situation, but for all similarly situated criminal activity or prosecution. Is that not sufficient?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I caught that. If the bright line rule is you can't turn it over.
It's, yeah.
And if they violate that rule, then the remedy, I think you almost go to a Castigar hearing, and if it's, I think the trial judge would be able to look at the extent of the violation and perhaps could formulate a remedy. But if it's premeditated, if it's not an accident, and they try and frame this, you know, they've made references to exposure to the file. This wasn't an accident. This is not only premeditated. I mean, it was fairly extensive. I think in those circumstances, there's no reason not to have dismissal be the remedy. I think that puts the end to it, because if you're the prosecutor and you know, if I get this statement and they find out about it, my case is going to go, even if it is a murder case. And maybe that should be the rule. If there's evidence that it's done intentionally.
Well, I guess, although counsel for Fifth Amendment violations, or if there's a confession and there's the problem there, the court would suppress and would not dismiss the case necessarily.
But I think if we were in a circumstance where you saw police officers routinely intentionally violating people's rights with the idea, we'll lose the statement, but we'll get the other benefits. Let's say they want to know information. And I think if police officers were routinely doing that, and if they were doing it on the advice of the prosecutor, I think it would be a much different circumstance. And I think that dismissal under those circumstances may be warranted. But this is not that case. This is something.
Well, counsel, are you saying because of a cumulative effect of other cases that information would come into the case before the court and they could fashion a remedy because this is the straw that broke the camel's back, so therefore I'm going to dismiss the case where a suppression remedy would be available otherwise?
Well, I think that's an extraordinary thing, but I think a trial court does have, under 14th Amendment due process grounds, if you find that type of a pervasive violation of rights, I think a trial court could do that, but I think that would be a very rare circumstance.
I think that's where the argument that you're asking for more rights comes from, in that you're asking for a dismissal rather than a suppression.
Well, but the reason I ask for that is not because of the nature of the person's employment. It's simply the nature, this is a premeditated violation of a promise that they made, and not just because it's a public employee. My time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Iams. Mr. Lamadou, Mr. Tatarsky used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just briefly want to bring to the court's attention and remind the court that the Fifth District did conclude that there was no use of any of the information here. The court did conclude that. So there was a finding by the Fifth Appellate District that there was absolutely no use of Mr. Vann. And moreover, the trial court itself concluded that I understand that the prosecution can proceed without any reference to any of the Garrity material or any material gained from it. So there was no use, and everyone acknowledged that the prosecution could proceed even without it.
So how would you view Mr. Vann's position here in his use?
If I'm the trial judge, or if I'm the prosecutor, rather, I'm going to discharge my Castigar burden by telling the court Judge, there's no dispute that we know about Mr. Van only by virtue of the Garrity statement. That's not a problem because we're not going to present him, and therefore the judge can use his or her authority to say, that's fine. You can't prove an independent source for Mr. Van, and the prosecutor, therefore, is simply not allowed to call Mr. Van, use his statement, or in any way reference his statement. I think that's what the Castigar hearing is for, and that's all we're saying that the trial court judge should have done, is just instead of dismissing it because the prosecutor had some knowledge of Mr. Van, simply instruct the prosecutor, as and with many other evidentiary rulings, you just can't call Mr. Van, you can't reference his statement, and you can't impeach anybody based upon it.
But I think the countervailing argument is that because we've interviewed Mr. Van and we know exactly what his version is, we can alter how we treat the rest of the case. We can alter how we cross-examine the police officer if he takes the stand. We can alter a lot of things that, and never refer to Mr. Van, but because we know about him through the Garrity statement and we interviewed him, we have a whole different view of the case. I think that's the unringing of the bell that is so troubling. How do you take that out and how do you prove that when it's such an esoteric thing, but it actually is dramatically going to affect how you prosecute?
It is esoteric, but what we would say is, what the federal court cases that we cited in our brief say is, and this goes somewhat to the deterrent effect. Listen, prosecutor, if you're going to go get the case, if you're going to get this internal affairs case and get the Garrity statement, your burden under Castigar is going to get heavier. It's going to get more difficult for you to demonstrate to the judge. And maybe at that point, the judge says, you can't demonstrate this to me. You can't show that you didn't actually make use of it, like in the Conrad case, where this court decided that the prosecutor had used it not only by cross-examining on that statement, which is a pretty obvious use, but had used the testimony from the Senate Judiciary Committee to actually formulate questions. What we're saying is if the prosecutor does decide, for whatever reason, because of Brady concerns or whatever, to get the IA case and the Garrity statements in it, then the remedy is, and what the prosecutor must do, is satisfy perhaps a burden that it's going to be a higher burden. Their job becomes more difficult, and that's all we're saying. Give the trial court judge the ability to make the prosecutor prove it where they choose to get the case.
So you would not want to see a bright line test saying or bright line rule that there can be no transfer of the disciplinary file to the prosecutor. The internal investigation file may not be shared with the prosecuting attorney.
Representing the city, of course, and not necessarily the county prosecutor, I don't have a position except to say that Garrity doesn't require it. All it prohibits is the use. That's all it would prohibit. So I would say a bright line rule would not be justified under Garrity.
So then, taking a look at it, if there were an expansion of Rule 16 and the discovery, where would you see a Garrity file falling in there?
I'm not entirely certain I understand all the discovery issues, but as I understand it, there's the Steckman case that this court handed down that basically says that public records requests can't be used to obtain criminal discovery. But the city would take the position that, we would be willing to live by the criminal rules, but I'm not entirely sure I understand. I mean, we're just talking about Garrity. I mean, as far as Garrity goes, Garrity does not prohibit us from giving the case to the prosecutor or the prosecutor from requesting it. That's just not what Garrity requires. It only prohibits the prosecutor from actually using it.
And it all boils down to what's your definition of using the file, whether it's for preparation and familiarizing yourself with the case, or as a roadmap, or as a shortcut to interviewing witnesses.
I think the way the trial court and the appellate court looked at it, it's the difference between direct and derivative use, which is what the Garrity statement that Canton read to Mr. Jackson requires. And I would urge the court to read the Garrity statement because it reflects actual use and derivative use. It in no way suggests that the file can't be forwarded to the prosecutor, requested by the prosecutor, nor does it suggest that it can't be used for some non-evidentiary purposes, which I would submit is almost impossible to define.
Which does make it different than a statement, an ordinary statement of a defendant that is compelled against the Fifth Amendment.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
You are making a distinction then in saying that this is not like a compelled Fifth Amendment statement from a defendant.
It is not. I mean, it's an involuntary Fifth Amendment statement, and that goes to our argument that if an entire prosecution is going to be barred by the prosecutor's knowledge of a Garrity statement, and because that Garrity statement is entitled to the same Fifth Amendment protection as an involuntary statement in a criminal case, so the only prosecution that's going to be absolutely barred and prohibited is the one dealing with the public employee. Yet the person who goes to the police department and has a confession coerced, that prosecutor can proceed with that case. And not only can the prosecutor proceed with that case, if that defendant chooses to take the stand, the prosecutor can cross-examine the defendant on that statement if they testify in contravention of their coerced statement.
But that only assumes that we agree with the remedy here. Or that we would agree that a dismissal was appropriate.
I would suppose that's correct.
All right. That's not what the Court of Appeals did, though.
They did not. They fashioned the remedy whereby the prosecutor had to purge their file of the Garrity statement and the internal affairs file, which I'm not sure that's justified under Garrity at all, and that a different prosecutor has to prosecute the case. But that is part and parcel of their interpretation of Garrity, that use equals knowledge, because if knowledge doesn't equal use, the entire remedy could be for the trial court simply to instruct the prosecutor as Castigar requires, which is do not present any evidence from Garrity or any evidence gained from it. That's all we're asking that this court do, is instruct the trial court to apply Castigar, and even in the cases where the prosecutor chooses to get the file, maybe that burden becomes heavier, but it's not an insurmountable burden. That's what it should not be, and that's what the McDaniels Federal Eighth Circuit case said. It was an insurmountable burden. The Supreme Court never said it should be an insurmountable burden if the prosecutor was aware of the Garrity file.
How would you have us apply the language from Castigar that I read to your co-counselor, to Ms. Tatarsky, that it, referring to the immunity, prohibits the prosecutorial authorities from using the compelled testimony in any respect, that therefore ensures testimony cannot lead to infliction of criminal penalties of the witness? In any respect, what is it, in any respect, is italicized? I assume that's from reading from the Supreme Court's original opinion. It's italicized. They put some emphasis on the word any. What does that mean?
I don't think they clarified it, because I don't think that this concept of non-evidentiary use was contemplated by the court.
We're talking about evidentiary.
Yeah, it's direct use, like the Garrity statement itself, and derivative use, which is, as in this case, Mr. Vann's a perfect example. He would be a derivative use. So any, I would suggest, means direct and derivative use of the statement. Any does not include, and there's no indication that should include, knowledge or a non-evidentiary use. That's how I read the word any, and because there's no indication that non-evidentiary was in any way contemplated by the court, I don't think it should have been applied in that way here.
What about investigatory use? Or use to, so that I know the case better? It's hard for us to determine that from a record, I think.
Those uses would be prohibited. Garrity does prohibit, and as a prosecutor, I'm required to prove at the Castigar hearing that I did not take that Garrity statement and further my investigation, go get other witnesses, get other evidence that would in any way rebut what the defendant said in that Garrity. Essentially, once you get Garrity, you can't do anything with it. So we have no problem with that. We have no problem with that application.
If you're asked at a hearing, did you have a better understanding of the defendant's case after you read this statement? What would the proper answer be?
I guess I can't. It depends on the case. I'm not sure that the prosecutor got any better understanding.
It would depend upon the veracity of the person making the response, I guess, wouldn't it?
It could be, but I would say that is much the same way as a prosecutor who has a involuntary or coerced confession in a criminal case. That prosecutor is going to know exactly what that defendant has said, but the remedy is simply it goes to the trial court, and giving the trial court the authority to say, prosecutor, you have to prove to me, that's what Castigar requires, you've got this Garrity file, now you've got to prove to me that all of the evidence that you're going to present is independent of the Garrity statement, and the case does say you have to go line by line if necessary. Now, we don't doubt that that's a tough thing to do, and it may be time-consuming, But that's what Castigar requires. It does not in any way require a dismissal of the case, or it does not prohibit the prosecutor from knowing about the Garrity statement.
Counsel, I wonder if for a moment if I might explore if there's a possible wider context for this. Would our decision in this case have any impact, conversely, on the internal affairs investigation?
I think, if the ruling were that knowledge equals use, as the appellee claims, as a city, in advising our police department and Internal Affairs Bureau, we have to sit down and really make an evaluation as to whether it's worth it to even offer a Garrity interview. And that would depend upon the severity of the crime. And so you may have police officers or public employees doing things that are lower level crimes, or I'm not sure what kind of crimes, but we then would have to make a decision. We're at real risk here if we take this Garrity statement, because you just don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it could be as simple as a public records request. Once that person has been charged, they're no longer an uncharged suspect, and that is a public record. If somebody wants to come get the internal affairs file and the Garrity statement, we have to release that.
Well, counsel, why not just wait on the Garrity process? Is there an urgency to do that before the whole criminal matter is sorted out after the criminal justice system takes a look at it?
Well, that would obviously that's going to depend on that. There's going to be a wide range of cases. In some cases, I would say absolutely yes. As an employer, we absolutely should be able to find out the wrongdoing of our employees and to discharge them accordingly far in advance of any criminal proceeding, control over which we have none. I mean, as an employer, we can't control the Stark County Prosecutor's Office. We can't control how quickly the Perry Police Department does their investigation. It could theoretically take months or as long as the statute of limitations. So I would say absolutely, as a public employer, we have a need in many cases to do these investigations as quickly as possible. Now, I'm not going to suggest to you that we need to take a Garrity interview in every case and we need to do it right now. I don't mean to suggest that at all. But I would say that there are definitely cases where we're going to need to do that quickly and where we should.
Counsel, let me ask you back to the internal affairs investigation. If we should determine that it was improper to turn over this statement to the prosecutor entirely, does that have an effect on, in this case, an internal affairs investigation that might violate a city contract or have an impact upon civil service regulations, that the city acted improperly in taking and turning over this statement? I'm just
there
trying to explore this case so you don't foresee any
I'm
problem
aware
with that.
No, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lamadou.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.